recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it on your iPad, iPod, or whatever device you listen to things on. Today we have a real interesting show on how three different judges react to the field of machine-assisted review. Initially in October last year, I talked to Judge Peck about doing a podcast just about his fabulous article on the topic called Search Forward, which at this point in time, everyone in the e-discovery field now knows about. But with scheduling challenges, we pushed the show back. And as we got later in the year, I then thought back to December 9, 2010, when Maura Grossman and I visited a conference room at a New York City law firm and presented some data and using different machine-assisted review techniques to a number of influential judges, primarily from the Southern District of New York, who were present both live and via WebEx. And I thought to myself, why not bring back three of these judges to do a holiday-like show modeled on the three tenors who together have made such great music together and talk about machine-assisted review. And since these three judges have been spending time studying this topic, I thought it made sense. So the three judges on today's show are the Honorable Andrew Peck, Frank Moss, and Judge Francis, and all of them work for the federal court system in the Southern District of New York. I also want to disclose, though it comes as no surprise to frequent listeners of ESI Bytes, that I am a biased presenter here. Back on December 9th, though, 2010, when Maura Grossman and I presented this topic to the judges, I found myself talking about compelling TREC results about technology, which outstripped the tools that I sold at that time. It was a moment when I realized this makes no sense. I'm spending a lot of professional time pushing a field forward into a space which I don't even participate in. And so now 14 months later, I do work closely with the machine-assisted review world. And so, yes, I'm very biased, and I thought the listeners should hear that. But I do have a standing offer at ESI Bytes to anyone who believes strongly in linear review and keywords that they can do a show stacked with guests who believe this is the way to go. In addition, I have no influence over the guests on the show. This is less about what I believe and more about the judges on the show and what they believe. So with that in mind, let me introduce our guests. Magistrate Judge Andrew J. Peck was appointed United States Magistrate Judge for the Southern District of New York February 27, 1995, served as Chief Magistrate Judge in 2004 to 2005, graduated with honors from Cornell University in 1974, and from Duke University School of Law in 1977, where he was notes and comments editor of the Duke Law Journal. Judge Peck served as a law clerk to Judge Paul Roney of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th, then 5th Circuit during the 1977-1978 term. Judge Peck was then an associate and then a counsel at the law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison from 1978 to 1995. Judge Peck is an adjunct professor at Cardozo Law School, where he teaches a course in pretrial practice. He's also a frequent lecturer on issues relating to electronic discovery and is a member of the Sedona Conference. Magistrate Judge Frank Moss was sworn into office on June 1, 1999. He received a BA degree in 1972 from Harper College of the State University of New York at Binghamton and a JD degree in 1976 from the New York University School of Law, where he served as articles editor of the Journal of International Law and Politics. From 1976 to 1978, Judge Moss served as a law clerk to the late Henry F. Worker, United States District Judge for the Southern District of New York. After nearly 2 years as a litigation associate at Curtis Mallett Prevost Colt Mosel, he was appointed as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York, where he served in the criminal division until 1986. From 1986 to 1995, he was an associate and then a partner in the New York City office of Phillips, Lytle, Hitchcock, Blaine, and Huber, a Buffalo-based law firm. In 1995, Judge Moss was appointed deputy commissioner, and in 1996, first deputy commissioner of the New York City Department of Investigation, while also serving as deputy commissioner and special counsel of the New York City Department of Business Services. As first deputy commissioner, he was responsible for the day-to-day operations of an internal affairs agency with nearly 400 employees, including attorneys, police officers, and civilian investigators. Judge Moss also oversaw the city's internet security efforts and its landmark effort to rid the Fulton fish market of organized crime influence. Our last panelist, Magistrate Judge James C. Francis IV, has been a United States Magistrate Judge in the Southern District of New York since 1985, serving as Chief Magistrate Judge from 1998 to 2000. Justice Francis graduated summa cum laude from Yale College in 1974, where he was a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He received his Juris Doctor degree from the Yale Law School in 1978 and a master's degree in public policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University in the same year. Following graduation from law school, Judge Francis clerked for the Honorable Robert L. Carter in the Southern District of New York. He then joined the Civil Appeals and Law Reform Unit of the Legal Aid Society, where he conducted impact litigation in the areas of housing, education, and the rights of disabled persons. He's also an adjunct professor at Fordham University Law School, where he teaches constitutional torts. Glad to have all three of you on the show, and why don't we start the show? Since Judge Moss is a new guest on ESI Bites, I thought I'd start with our initial question of how you each got started in electronic discovery. So we'll start with you, Judge Moss, then Judge Francis, and Judge Peck.
Well, I've always had an interest in technology and have been an early adopter. I'm usually the person online for the newest gadget when it comes out. So when the first case that presented an e-discovery issue came before me, I jumped at it and wrote a decision that I found generated interest well beyond anything I'd previously written, and found folks like you reaching out to me and asking me questions about the field, which caused me the need to learn more and more about it.
Yeah, it sucks you in. How about you, Judge Francis?
Well, as in all things related to electronic discovery, my first experience came with Judge Shindlin. She asked me back in 2001 to accompany her to the first of the colloquia designed to ascertain what changes should be made in the federal rules to accommodate electronic discovery, and that piqued my interest, and when I saw a case come onto my docket that raised those issues, I also jumped at it, wrote an opinion, and that opinion got some notoriety, and I began to speak at conferences where I learned more than I conveyed, and consequently continued to gain information and interest in this area.
And Judge Peck, yourself?
In 1995, shortly after I was appointed, I wrote a decision in a case anti-monopoly against Hasbro, which is totally irrelevant except for one line that Judge Shindlin likes to quote in law review articles occasionally, and that is where I said that by then it was black-letter law that computerized information was discoverable. Then I had no further involvement till shortly before the December 2006 rules amendments were coming down the pike, and I was asked to speak at a conference in some lovely resort area, and they said, pick a topic. And since I knew those rules were coming down, and I'm somewhat of a rules junkie, I volunteered to and spoke about that. And then with the joys of Google or whatever, I started getting calls, oh, you're an expert on this area. Since you've spoken about it once, will you please talk to us? And similar to what Jay and Frank have said, I've been asked to speak a lot about it. I learn more from the conferences than I do from my cases quite often, and I'm interested in it and keep staying involved and up to date with it.
Great. So let's start in on a couple of the questions. And you know, one thing I didn't mention before we start, if any of you have additional comments to one of the answers, feel free to chime in. So let's start back to the discussion we had in December 2010 in New York when we were talking about organizing information-related clusters. I think I had Judge Peck play Judge Francis in a card game I like to do, and one of the judges got a shuffle deck, if you can imagine that, and the other one was handed pretty close to a full house. Based on that demonstration, or common sense, does it make sense, Judge Moss, to organize information together to make review faster than to look at it haphazardly when reviewing it?
Well, that's a little like asking whether I'm in favor of motherhood and apple pie, but at a minimum, I'd expect that when people do large document reviews of electronic files, that the files would be deduplicated for review and email strings would be reviewed of a piece. But I find it amazing how often, even on substantial reviews, attorneys tell me they haven't taken those basic steps, which I guess are these days fairly rudimentary.
And that's an interesting point, because both those steps require using technology to influence what you're reviewing. So I think that's a really good point. From that point, we moved in that discussion, December of 2010, we moved into a discussion of preliminary TREC results, which showed that each of the machine-assisted review tools that had entered TREC in 2009 had beaten the Blair-Maren's 20% recall measure for finding relevant information. So the question, Judge Peck, is once we train a technology to organize information into batches that make sense, if we can label some of those batches as relevant to a case, aren't we improving the field of e-discovery?
Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, I mean, to clarify that, you know, machine-assisted review is very similar to concept searching, where similar words and noun phrases in a document causes similar documents to be grouped together, sort of like a magnet or a sort button in Excel. And then reviewers review the documents in concept clusters. In machine-assisted review, the software algorithms are grabbing similar documents together, but the similarities are based on the tagging of a seed set of documents by reviewers or a reviewer to create a seed set to train the algorithm. That algorithm then runs, and an unreviewed set of documents are identified that are similar to the seed set, which were coded as responsive. And that's based on similarities in the word, senders, proximity, and other reasons. So forget about validating it. We'll talk about that later. Let's just talk about the outcome. In theory, isn't this a good thing?
Absolutely. You know, the thing to remember is that all of this requires not just technology, but process, workflow, and humans. You know, we're never going to get to that famous New York Times article where lawyers have no role in the review. But the more one uses the computer-assisted approach, the more objective the result is, so it's replicable. If someone says, how come this document was not grouped as responsive, you can rerun the set and show why, while if you're doing just concept analysis and then a more subjective human review, human reviewers make mistakes. So I think that you know, all of that, as Judge Moss was saying before, is better than just linear review, but in the appropriate case with the appropriate process, computer-assisted review will be cheaper and give a better product.
Let me follow up for a second on both of those last answers. We've been talking, I think, primarily about the clustering of documents from whatever the universe is that was originally collected. I'd like to take a step back. It seems to me that there's also value in thinking about the collection process and the extent to which human input is involved there. It's going to make a lot more sense to use the poker analogy if at the outset, if what you're looking for is the royal flush, if you can eliminate from the deck all of the non-face cards, then you have narrowed your search significantly. And that's something that may not need much in the way of machine assistance at all. It's a preliminary step that common sense tells you that lawyers ought to be taking.
And there are lots of holes in that collection effort based on the inability to organize information that companies have. So there are gaps throughout this process that could possibly impact whatever machine you're using.
Sure.
So I think that's a good, very good point. Now I'd like to move to the present. Is there now a number of commercial products which use machine-assisted review techniques? And for those who are not familiar with these tools, they work like spam filters do on a computer. They separate documents into categories of relevant and non-relevant, just like a spam filter separates emails between spam and something that might be worth reading. The difference is we know pretty much what junk email looks like and how to train tools to look for that. You need to train the tools to work on ESI for litigation before they're going to work like a spam filter or may act like a responsiveness filter. And these tools, of course, use different algorithms, different approaches to train themselves before you push that button and say, code the rest of the document. So let's talk about validating using these types of tools in front of a court. And Judge Francis, you recently moderated a presentation at Georgetown on statistics in e-discovery. If you don't know how a machine-assisted review tool works, can you still become comfortable with the tool if you can measure the results on the back end? I mean, aren't those results the most important factor?
Well, I certainly think that irrespective of whether you actually understand the algorithms, both courts and attorneys can get some comfort level from engaging in what is basically statistical quality control. That is, you could run your review, identify what are considered relevant and non-relevant documents, then, for example, sample the non-relevant documents to establish how reliable your search has been. And if you find that there are large numbers of what are in fact relevant documents within that sample, then you recognize that there's a problem and you go back and try to analyze it. You might also want to look at the relevant documents and take a sample of those to determine how precise your machine-assisted review has been. Now, from the court's point of view, I think the issue is going to be what are acceptable error levels. It's inevitable in any search that you're going to that it's going to be imprecise. That is, that you're going to have some relevant documents that slip through and are categorized as non-relevant, what kind of accuracy the court demands is going to be the interesting question down the line.
I think one of the interesting questions that is going to arise is if you want your seed set to be as responsive and informative as possible, it may be that you will want to use privileged documents as part of the seed set, and when people try to dissect the process that the producing party went through or reconstruct it, we will end up with some interesting privilege questions that arise.
Yeah, I have said at a prior conference, I didn't think about the privilege seeds, but that in the appropriate case, if there were a challenge to the process, I might well require the party using computer-assisted review to produce their seed set for the other side so that, you know, going back to the old computer expression of GIGO, garbage in, garbage out, to make sure that the seed set was appropriately chosen and appropriately coded to reveal relevant documents, not to hide the smoking guns.
You're also going to get a problem not just with privileged documents, but with confidential documents, documents that wouldn't raise attorney-client issues, but might be something they certainly don't want to reveal to their adversary.
You know, actually, I liked that first point. I mean, I liked all those points, but, you know, one of the challenges with using these tools is getting to the point where you've trained them. And if you can get your hands around your privileged documents, which deal with the issue, you might have an interesting beginning point to actually train your tool. Then you take your privileged documents out. But those are some interesting ideas. Judge Francis, though, as a follow-up question, do you think it makes sense in today's world for the parties to do the same statistical monitoring of data sets produced using keyword searching on linear review to see what we're missing? I mean, isn't it just a good idea, regardless of how you select ESI, to sample what you're missing?
Oh, yeah. You certainly want to engage in quality control regardless of the tools that you're using, and that's going to, you know, that's going to be the defense that you have when there's an inadvertent disclosure. It's going to be how you determine whether your privilege logs are accurate. You're going to need to do quality control regardless, and the statistics statistical sampling gives you a way to do that.
So, Judge Moss, obviously in today's world, cooperation and openness is the best way to sell these newer tools to the other party who aren't familiar with them maybe but are in litigation with you. But if the parties can't reach agreement, how do you think a disagreement is going to play out in court?
I think the first issue is whether or not the producing party has disclosed that it's using machine-assisted or computer-assisted review. Your question assumes that there has been disclosure, and I think there are some people who would debate whether or not that's necessary. I happen to think disclosure is necessary, but I think it would play out like any other discovery dispute. First, there'd be an informal conference with the court. There might later be proffers by both sides regarding the technology and why it works or doesn't work. I could conceive of demonstrations for the court. I doubt you'd get to the stage of a formal evidentiary hearing, and I know people have debated back and forth whether ultimately there'd be a Daubert hearing, but I don't think it would ever rise to that level. I think through a series of increasingly pointed inquiries, there'd be some examination of whether it did or did not work in the instance that was before the court.
Although I do think that it's always better for the issue to come up front before it's used than afterwards, with the potential that the party who used it would have to do a redo because they either didn't do it right despite the tool or because they were in front of a Luddite judge or whatever it may be who didn't accept it. I personally think that it is required to reveal this during the 26F process and the iterations after the 26F as to what you're doing. I'll also tell one quick war story, which is in the first case where I know that the parties are using predictive coding. They had a conference in front of me, a general discovery status conference, and the defendant was saying that they were about to use predictive coding, but that they had not yet had a buy-in from the plaintiff. And I just smiled and said, "And when you got assigned to me, you, the defendant, must have thought you died and went to heaven," in light of my search article in Law Technology News. And indeed, whether because of that comment or otherwise, plaintiff said, "Oh, no, we're okay with using computer-assisted review. We just had some questions about the exact process," and they went out and they worked it all out.
The alternative was to ask you to recuse yourself, I suppose, Andy.
No doubt.
So, Judge Peck, you know, since you like rules a lot, how does the concept of proportionality, which are embedded in Rule 26G1, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and elsewhere, assist in making it easier to convince a court that this approach makes sense?
You know, as we've said before, we're not expecting perfection. Even in the linear review, the old-fashioned hands-on review, nothing was ever perfect, and the court does not expect perfection. And at some point, it really is a question of how much justice can the parties afford. And one of the things that the computer-assisted review tools allow you to do is at some point say, we've trained the process, we've gone through iterations, we've done a statistical sampling of the material, I'll call it the tail, the stuff that the system has determined to be non-relevant, and say to the other side, yeah, we could do a hands-on lawyer review of that remaining X million documents, and that's going to cost us, you know, how many millions of dollars, but based on our statistical sample where we found one minorly relevant document out of a statistical sample, and therefore the expectation is we will find next to nothing in this non-responsive set, why should we go through the cost of that? And I think that's where proportionality will be very helpful and where computer-assisted review and proportionality really tie in together.
Yeah, it's almost like the backup tape analogy, where when you start having to fish around, you might look for cost shifting. So, well, Judge Francis, I don't know if this could happen, but in a weird world, would you entertain a request if a party wanted to use linear review and the other party wanted to use machine-assisted review, presuming they both had data, to compel the side using linear review to use technology based on the fear that they're missing out on providing relevant ASI that the machine-assisted people are actually providing the other side?
Well, I think the answer is no for two reasons, one legal and one practical. The legal reason is I don't think that I have the authority to dictate to a party the means by which it engages in discovery, particularly because the federal rules, I think, assumed linear review, right? That was what existed when the rules were enacted, and I don't think that we've seen any amendments that permit us to tell the parties not to use linear review. And the practical reason that I wouldn't issue such an order is, frankly, while we know that statistically machine-assisted review is much better, I don't know whether in this particular instance, given the way a party is going to go about its linear review, that linear review is going to be materially worse than the machine-assisted review would be. In other words, I can't infer from the statistical advantages and superiority of machine-assisted review whether that would play out in this particular case the same way. So the answer is no, I wouldn't order it. I do what I could to encourage it, because I think 9 times out of 10 it's certainly going to be better, but I don't think I can mandate it.
I think you also need to be thinking about what is the size of the case. You know, how many documents are there? If it is a traditional, you know, state court type small document case, and they use very good attorneys, not just, you know, lowest cost outside Farm Belt or India review without training, et cetera, et cetera. It could, in that situation, be a case where linear review works just fine. On the other hand, if you get a case with, you know, megabytes and millions of documents, I'm not even sure that any party is going to say to us, oh, we're going to use linear review of, you know, eyes on review of every single email and other form of ESI. More likely, the fight will be over keywords versus computer-assisted review.
I agree with that, although I will tell you that mathematicians who know more about this than I tell me that the advantages of machine-assisted review are not dependent on the size of the review set.
Yeah, I want to make one point on this, too. There was an excellent three-part blog post that Ralph Losey published a couple weeks ago, and he made the same point about, for like 500 documents, people are more accurate. Although I agree with most of what's in that blog post, I've built a web-based test called ReviewWrite to test reviewers, and I will tell you, on a short test of 10 documents, I'm finding reviewers are not consistent in finding all the relevant documents, even on a small data set. So I agree with that last point. But I
also agree generally with Jay, but I think if you were moving along in a big document case and there was evidence that linear review was not succeeding, it would be more tempting to order specific measures than at the outset, when I think parties certainly should have the right to do their review whatever way they see fit.
Interesting. Well, this is a question directed at the right audience because last week or earlier this week, I did a podcast on the pilot program in the Southern District of New York for complex litigation with Maura Grossman, Arianna Tadler, and Chris Dale. And in the materials we covered is the e-discovery order, which includes an assessment by the parties on search and retrieval. And this order is used by both parties to document their meet and confer process and where they have agreements and disagreements. And the text right out of the order describing the search approach used by the parties describes the following. Quote, the parties have discussed methodologies or protocols for the search and re-review of electronically stored information, as well as the disclosure of techniques to be used. Some of the approaches that may be considered include the use and exchange of keyword search lists, hit reports and or responsiveness rates, concept search, machine learning, or other advanced analytical tools, et cetera, et cetera. So Judge Peck, from reading the model order, can it be inferred from this explicit inclusion in the New York example model order that the Southern District of New York is very open to using machine-assisted review techniques and that we're beyond science fiction now and gaining judicial acceptance?
Well, we're clearly beyond science fiction. Perhaps the caveat needs to be known that the committee of the bar and court that dealt with this complex litigation program was chaired by Judge Shindlin, who obviously is way ahead of most judges on these ESI-related issues. But I think in general, it is clear that as a generality, although a specific judge may be different, that we are open to machine learning and other advanced tools.
At that December 9th, 2010 presentation, we had an interesting discussion on what could judges do to push the ball forward and encourage parties to embrace more technology approaches to reduce the burden of searching for ESI and improve its accuracy. In fact, I think one of the comments from one of the judges was, well, what can we do to help? And I think I've seen a number of examples from each of you where you've stepped forward and talked or written about using more technology. And I'd like to ask each of you where you are on this space at this point in time. So Judge Peck, if I could start with you and your article, Search Forward, Time for Computer-Assisted Coding, and the keynote address you gave at Carmelli Discovery Retreat in 2011. You've come out pretty publicly as an advocate for parties to use these tools. And what's caused you to reach these conclusions?
What's caused me to reach these conclusions is twofold. As all of us were saying before, when we go to various conferences and speak, we also listen. And I think it's become quite clear that these tools, when used the right way, are very, very effective. And we've also been sitting through all sorts of discussions about whether the federal rules should be further amended because of the costs of e-discovery and preservation and production. And a lot of that cost comes from lawyers doing too much hands-on or eyes-on review without the appropriate assistance of technology. If we don't want to drive litigants out of the court system because the expense is just too great for anything other than a bet your company case, we need to be cognizant of that and yet fair to the opposing party to give them the information they need to prove their case. And I think computer-assisted review is one tool to help in that goal.
Judge Moss, I heard what I thought was an outstanding webinar for the ABA, which you gave with Maura Grossman and Professor Cormack in August of last year, where you were also suggesting that the UK opinion Goodale was the only case you'd seen embracing these approaches, and you facetiously asked Maura Grossman how to cite her article in an opinion you might write if you had the chance. So what's caused you to form these opinions in this space today?
Well, I think the point I was trying to make in the ABA session was, as we've demonstrated today, that every judge who considers himself or herself an e-discovery maven would love a chance to weigh in the context of an actual case, much as Judge Peck has done in his article. But, you know, the reality everybody faces, judges, litigants, lawyers, is that costs are very high for discovery, and so we need innovative solutions, one of which is technology-assisted review. And I think it's inevitable, as Judge Peck was saying, that it will be in either the current format or in some way that we can't yet envision, part of the way that people collect and review and produce documents. But by the same token, I think it has to be said that there are some very sophisticated practitioners out there who are very skeptical of the process of machine-assisted review and not yet ready to use it in their own cases.
And Judge Francis, I don't want to specifically repeat the exact same question, but, you know, understanding that in life, as we approach, you know, anything, it's an evolution and we learn more over time. And before we even did that training in 2010, we did an ESI Bytes podcast together with Megan Jones and Bob Trenchard when I was trying to ask about the parties moving away from keywords unilaterally. In fact, I think I asked Bob Trenchard, you know, you've invested in these systems, why don't you just do it without agreement? And you said at the time you might want to know about this before a party undertook those steps. But now we're a couple of years later, 2012. Where are you in this space of machine-assisted review? Do you really want to know before the parties undertake this?
Well, I think I still want to know, not because I think that it's so exotic that I might tell them not to, but rather because I think it's important for them to be transparent both with the court and with their adversary. You know, we were talking earlier about raising these issues early on so that you head off objections, and I think that's important. I think many parties will still come in with skepticism about these kinds of technologies, but I'd like to air that out early on in the process. So if I can get them to tell me what they're doing, even if I'm not giving it judicial imprimatur, at least the other side now knows about it and can get more comfortable and not be surprised later. So I am still interested in having them raise it early, but not because I am skeptical myself about the approach.
Okay. You know, the other thing that I think may be going on here, though, is as hands-on as the three of us may be in managing our cases, I suspect that while there still, to my knowledge, has not been a U.S. case embracing the concept of computer-assisted review or even its use, parties are using it. And unless there is a dispute and or unless we really push at the Rule 16 or some other conference to say, okay, you've told us there are no disputes, that you've worked out a way to handle ESI, etc., you know, unless we're pushing, it is quite likely or at least possible that parties are using computer-assisted review in cases, but there's no dispute, and if the judge isn't asking, we don't know. The other thing is, it may well be that parties may be producing in some other way, but then using computer-assisted review as a way to sort and analyze the material they receive from their adversary.
Yep, those are good points. So Judge Peck, if people willfully do bad things or are grossly negligent, and if that's what causes sanctions to be enforced by a court, do you think with proper sampling it's easier to trust a software algorithm as opposed to people not to hide something? I mean, can't you just evaluate that seed set that's used to set the responsiveness filter if you have any misgivings?
You know, I think there are cases like Judge Grimm's decision in the second Victor Stanley case showed where parties actually are going out and are, you know, lying, cheating, eliminating material, et cetera, et cetera. In many more cases, what we're seeing is really ineptness, lawyers not knowing what they're doing. But yes, I think in general, the benefit of computer-assisted review, among others, is that it should be replicable. So if you have 25 different lawyers reviewing a million documents, keywords to sort them to a more manageable set or not, most lawyers probably would not necessarily rank every single document the same if they had to do it a second time to prove replicability. But with the computer, whatever the seed set is, whatever the so-called black box algorithm in the computer is, if you run that five times, you'll get the same result. And I think that does give parties comfort. And again, it goes back to cooperation and transparency between the parties up front will make the fears of game playing much reduced.
Well, but though based on Victor Stanley too, we could also say that you don't avoid sanctions simply by using machine-assisted review. If you do that without any quality control, and you don't test your so-called non-relevant documents to see if in fact that set includes responsive documents, then you have certainly been negligent. And perhaps grossly negligent in your production.
That's a very good point, because these tools only replicate what you've told them to look for through establishing your seed set. So if you've done a bad job of setting up your seed set, you're just going to get incomplete data.
Or for that matter, if you have a computer glitch, right? I mean, we've been assuming that the technology works perfectly, and that's not always the case. There are cases out there where parties have been sanctioned because the product that the vendor provided them with went haywire.
Yes, as we hear the humming in the background of this podcast, we are reminded technology is not quite perfect. But anyway, each of you gave really good examples of how interested you are in this space, and you've all invested a good deal of time getting familiar with using technology in the practice of law. I'd like to start with you, Judge Peck, but if anyone else wants to add anything, do you have any advice for others, such as judges or lawyers, on what they can do to become more comfortable with analytical reviews, such as machine-assisted review?
I mean, certainly for federal judges, there is a annual training program that they can go to dealing with electronic discovery issues. In addition, going to conferences, whether by judges or lawyers, even being in the audience is a great way to learn. And it seems to me, even though the people, when we walk around, whether it's legal tech or other things, and they look at our badge and they see that we're from the court system, we're not going to be a customer, nevertheless, it seems like every vendor is not only happy but going out of their way to try to volunteer to come back and train us on the various types of technology that are available. So if you want to learn, there are ways to do it. For lawyers, I would also say, know about your judge, and if your judge is not one of the so-called recognized e-discovery speakers, it really is incumbent upon the lawyers in a particular case to educate the judge with respect to the information needed for that case, and they should not hesitate to bring their consultant or whoever else it may be to a conference to do that.
I think that lawyers should be encouraged to test drive these things. You know, I understand why lawyers are reluctant to turn loose an untested technology, untested from their point of view, on a multi-million-dollar case, but I suspect that with it, for a reasonable cost, they could utilize review tools on either a smaller case or a set of public domain documents and see how these things work. And I think once they try their hand at it, they'll be more comfortable with it.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned there, Judge Peck, and I'm going to ask you this, Judge Moss, but if any of these three have an opinion, do you get a sense from going to judicial training on this topic and talking to other judges that that, you know, first within New York and then beyond that, that there's becoming an acceptance of these tools within the judicial community?
Well, I think that in truth, there are still many judges whose understanding of e-discovery is fairly rudimentary. I think it's improving daily because of things like the Federal Judicial Center seminars and state court efforts along the same lines. And obviously, judges are curious about new technologies, but inevitably it distracts from their main job, which is deciding cases. So I don't think there are enough judges yet across the country who are very knowledgeable about e-discovery, and therefore no consensus certainly about machine-assisted review. Jay mentioned earlier that we learn as much as at the conferences as perhaps we impart, maybe more so. One of the things I often ask through a show of hands at conferences is practitioners to tell me what percentage of the judges they appear before in state or federal court they think are knowledgeable about these issues. And although I haven't asked the question recently, the highest percentage I've ever gotten is 20%. And I think within that 20%, a consensus may be emerging, but that's about as far as I'd go in terms of suggesting that there's some agreement.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because I had the pleasure of seeing Judge Moss recently present at a conference that we were both at, and I threw out the question to a panel of judges, and one of the judges frankly said, in terms of using these tools, not in their lifetime. Now, to be fair, I talked to the judge afterwards, and he had not really been exposed to this area. So education is going to be a big part of this, I think, for a lot of judges, unless you get Judge Peck. Just like your other war story earlier. the next question I have involves a theory which I've started writing about, that the real culprit on whether these tools get accepted is not the defensibility argument and how judges will react. It's rather the reluctance by lawyers to use these tools because they don't understand them, and they're the ones that get to decide whether or not you use them. And I think one of the judges back on December 9th, 2010, made that point about not being in a position to tell the parties what to do. And in preparing this presentation, I read an interesting blog post from the Masters Conference held late last fall, so not so long ago, that noted some of the attendance members said they were uncomfortable using this technology without agreement from opposing counsel and may not even use it at all until there was a case certifying its use. So the question for you, Judge Francis, is, how do we tell parties that these tools aren't so bad?
Well, certainly the easy answer to that is that we give them comfort in our initial pretrial conferences. And when we talk about the discovery plans that they have, we ask them questions about what technologies they're using and make it clear that that's not a scary prospect from our perspective. Now, we obviously don't have the authority, as I said earlier, to force them to use a particular technology. We do, however, have the authority to manage litigation in a way that discourages inefficiencies. So, for example, it seems to me that if a party has the resources and should have access to machine-assisted technology, but they're going to insist on doing an eyes-on review, they're going to get less sympathy from me when they ask for adjournments and things of that nature. I don't have a rocket docket like Judge Peck does, but I do hold parties to deadlines, and I'm not going to extend those deadlines if they insist on using outdated methods of discovery.
The other thing I'd like to point out is that the same lawyers who say they're uncomfortable using computer-assisted review without a decision blessing it are, it seems, perfectly comfortable using keyword methodology. And, you know, in my decision in the William A. Gross case, in Judge Grimm's decision in Victor Stanley, Judge Facciola's decision in O'Keefe, All the decisions that I've read on keyword search, I have not seen one that says keyword searching is the appropriate way to search in all cases, period. All of the major decisions, including the three I just mentioned, criticized the way the parties did their use of keywords. I don't think you're going to get a universal, you know, adoption certification, whatever you want to call it. As I said in my search article, and I have to give credit for Chris Dale for sort of coming up with this language, but if someone is looking for a judicial opinion that says to the effect of, it is the opinion of this court that the use of predictive coding is a proper and acceptable means of conducting searches in accordance with the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and furthermore, that the software provided for this purpose by, insert name of your favorite vendor, is the software of choice in this court, you're going to have a very long wait, like probably till hell freezes over, to see that opinion. Now, having said that, I am somewhat concerned that I would not like to see the first opinion on predictive coding be one where the parties messed it up and the judge is highly critical, or that the judge does not really understand it and totally disavows its use. But I don't think the parties in this day and age can just wait and say we're waiting for a judicial blessing in a published opinion.
I think that supports Carl's theory. There aren't any cases out there that say that it's a bad thing, so there's no reason for counsel to be skittish. I think it's really more a function of attorneys being verbal and not mathematically oriented, so they feel more comfortable with keywords.
Yeah, no, thanks for agreeing with me. The two things I wanted to add there to follow on Judge Peck's point, a keyword is really a form of a predictive search. You're guessing, you're limiting yourself to a word, but you're trying to pull in other documents that have that keyword. The only difference is instead of using a keyword, you're taking the whole of a document and looking for other documents that are like it. But the mechanics are really pretty darn similar if you were to break down the computer. The other thing I want to throw out in terms of judges, in case other judges are listening to this, Judge Conte this week has brought in a technologist, Herb Reuplatt, to present machine-assisted review to all the judges that want to listen to it in the Western District of Pennsylvania, sort of an open court session. And that's a great way, you know, if you have an advocate judge to you know, and there are lots of companies that would be happy to do that. So there are lots of ways to spread the gospel. So, Judge Peck, you know, given what we just talked about, do you agree it's more the fault of the parties and not the judges that these tools aren't openly embraced in the field as the predominant way to find ESI?
The parties and their lawyers, yes.
Okay. The last question, Judge Moss, is what do you do if only one party doesn't trust the new search methods, regardless of one party's comfort level with technology? Isn't it up to each party to use the most capable tools at their disposal to perform their jobs? And just because one party doesn't understand the technology, should that impinge on the other party's ability to use such tools? You know, to put it bluntly, why should one person's ignorance of legal technology suppress the other party's ability to provide the best response at the lowest possible cost?
Well, Judge Francis has already said, I agree with him, that nobody should be able to compel the other side to use sophisticated technological review techniques, but I don't know of any reason why a party that needs to produce documents can't use those techniques on its own. And to the extent it's made disclosure and there's pushback from somebody who's wary of the new technologies, that's where the judge is your friend. Either the judge will know about this and encourage it, or it's your job to educate the judge such that the judge can form a decision, even if it's not in a formal opinion, that it's a reasonable way of proceeding. We get these sorts of questions at the non-technological level all the time. Do you harvest documents by going into the computer system and pulling them out, or is it sufficient to send an email to various custodians saying, go through your hard drive and send me all of the documents that are responsive? There's no right answer, and I think any producing party should have the freedom to use these technologies so long as it can show that it's followed a reliable method that it can defend.
Great. The final question could be off this topic, but I've just like I asked everyone how they got started in e-discovery, I like asking our guests now at the end, what do you see as the biggest issue in e-discovery right now on January 11th, 2012? This helps me come up with future shows, so there's lots of reasons, but we'll start with you, Judge Peck, and then Judge Francis, and then Judge Moss.
You know, 5 years after the December 2006 federal rules, I think a lot of us who go to these conferences, we're an inner group, we all drank the Kool-Aid, and we forget that we are a very small minority of the judges and lawyers practicing in the United States. So I still think lawyer competency or lack thereof and the failure to buy into the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation are still major, major problems. The one other is proportionality and cost containment. As we've been talking about with regard to the proposals to amend the rules and with regard to using computer-assisted review, unfortunately, companies are just letting their ESI accumulate and grow, are not using good record management tools, and then they get into litigation and are shocked at how expensive it is to cull that material for production. And we need to be cognizant of the proportionality concept to be fair to both sides to a litigation.
Okay. Judge Francis?
Well, I will second Andy's last point with respect to how important issues of preservation are because of the extraordinary costs involved both in the preservation itself and then in what do you do with it now that you have it. The other issue that I think is really, and perhaps it's not January 11th, 2012, perhaps it's even now still a horizon issue, is social media. I think social media is going to continue to be a real significant issue for e-discovery, not only because of the issues of preservation and collection of information, but beyond e-discovery, it affects merits issues, it affects jurisdictional issues. I think social media is going to cause the courts to rethink some of these fundamental legal concepts, both in e-discovery and elsewhere.
Great. You can be on a future podcast with that one, Judge Francis.
That's why great. I said it. Good.
And Judge Moss, it's always hard to go last or easiest, depending on if you just want to say, I'll take that one and that one.
Well, as judges, we like the fact that we usually have the last word. Each year there's been a different set of buzzwords, keywords at times, proportionality, sanctions, machine or technology-assisted review. But I really think the key issue now is the same as it was 10 years ago in 2001, and Andy alluded to it in terms of talking about records management, but the overarching theme is there has to be a way of reining in expense, and whether it's proportional discovery decisions or whether it's technology-assisted review, limitations on the number of custodians to search, we're all looking for ways to comply with Rule 1 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and basically to get through these cases faster, cheaper, and smarter. So I think everybody has the same goal. We're just sort of struggling to find our way to get there.
Great. Well, I want to thank each of you, Judge Moss, Peck, and Judge Francis, for joining us here at ESI Bites. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. That is ESI Bytes, which you can remember phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI information. But however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.